When you got to Hassan, you gave a banquet for the Kaith and served couscous made from the wheat?
We sure did. And you know those citizens were so loaded on that marijuana they all wig in the middle of the banquet.
The humming stopped. Johnny took his hatchet and slammed the blade down across the cables. It wasn't a full severance. He struck twice more. All the cables parted. Things were going blacker. No, it was the dome. The reworked plane skids on the bottom of it hit the metal. Johnny reached out to the dome interior and pulled closed the locking lever which annealed them to the metal the console sat on. It was very dark. He felt his time sense must have gone out, and then a fleeting thought that maybe Turl had extended the time for his own firing. Johnny had had a small mine lamp in his pouch.
Life which is contained in the loins of our own species. A dream begotten by the hatred of death upon the fear of true immortality, fondled in secret by thousands of ignorant men and hundreds who are not ignorant. The destruction or enslavement of other species in the universe, if such there are, is to these minds a welcome corollary. In Professor Weston, the power had at last met the dream. The great physicist had discovered a motive power for his spaceship. And that little black object, now floating beneath him on the sinless waters of Perelandra, looked to Ransom more like the spaceship every moment. So that, he thought, that is why I have been sent here. He failed on Malacandra, and now he is coming here. And it's up to me to do something about it. A terrible sense of inadequacy swept over him. Last time, in Mars, Weston had had only one accomplice. But he had had firearms. And how many accomplices might he have this time? And in Mars he had been foiled not by Ransom, but by the Eldila, and especially the great Eldil, the Oyarsa of that world. He turned quickly to the lady. "I have seen no Eldila in your world," he said. "Eldila," she repeated, as if it were a new name to her. "Yes, Eldila," said Ransom, "the great and ancient servants of Mel-Eldil. The creatures that neither breed nor breathe, whose bodies are made of light, whom we can hardly see, who ought to be obeyed." She mused for a moment and then spoke. "Sweetly and gently this time Mel-Eldil makes me older. He shows me all the natures of these blessed creatures. But there is no obeying them now, not in this world. That is all the old order, Piebald, the far side of the wave that has rolled past us and will not come again. That very ancient world to which you journeyed was put under the Eldila. In your own world also they ruled once, but not since our beloved became a man. In your world they linger still, but in our world, which is the first of worlds to wake after the great change, they have no power. There is nothing now between us and him. They have grown less, and we have increased. And now Mel-Eldil puts into my mind that this is their glory and their joy. They received us, us things of the low worlds who breed and breathe as weak and small beasts whom their lightest touch could destroy. And their glory was to cherish us and make us older till we were older than they, till they could fall at our feet. It is a joy we shall not have. However I teach the beasts, they will never be better than I. But it is a joy beyond all. Not that it is better joy than ours. Every joy is beyond all others. The fruit we are eating is always the best fruit of all."
"There have been Eldila who did not think it a joy," said Ransom.
"How?" "You spoke yesterday, lady, of clinging to the old good instead of taking the good that came."
"Yes, for a few heartbeats." "There was an Eldil who clung longer, who has been clinging since before the worlds were made."
"But the old good would cease to be a good at all if he did that."
"Yes, it has ceased, and still he clings."
She stared at him in wonder and was about to speak, but he interrupted her. "There is no time to explain," he said.
"No time? What has happened to the time?" she asked.
"Listen," he said. "That thing down there has come through deep heaven from my world. There is a man in it, perhaps many men."
"Look," she said, "it is turning into two, one big and one small."
Ransom saw that a small black object had detached itself from the spaceship and was beginning to move uncertainly away from it. It puzzled him for a moment. Then it dawned on him that Weston, if it was Weston, probably knew the watery surface he had to expect on Venus and had brought some kind of collapsible boat.
But could it be that he had not reckoned with tides or storms, and did not foresee that it might be impossible for him ever to recover the spaceship? It was not like Weston to cut off his own retreat, and Ransom certainly did not wish Weston's retreat to be cut off. A Weston who could not, even if he chose, return to Earth was an insoluble problem. Anyway, what could he, Ransom, possibly do without support from the Eldila? He began to smart under a sense of injustice. What was the good of sending him, a mere scholar, to cope with a situation of this sort? Any ordinary pugilist, or better still, any man who could make good use of a Tommy gun, would have been more to the purpose. If only they could find this king whom the Green Woman kept on talking about. But while these thoughts were passing through his mind, he became aware of a dim murmuring or growling sound which had gradually been encroaching on the silence for some time. "Look," said the lady suddenly, and pointed to the mass of islands. Their surface was no longer level. At the same moment he realized that the noise was that of waves, small waves as yet, but definitely beginning to foam on the rocky headlands of the fixed island. "The sea is rising," said the lady. "We must go down and leave this land at once. Soon the waves will be too great, and I must not be here by night." "Not that way," shouted Ransom. "Not where you will meet the man from my world."
"Why?" said the lady. "I am lady and mother of this world. If the king is not here, who else should greet a stranger?"
"I will meet him."
"It is not your world, Piebald," she replied.
"You do not understand," said Ransom. "This man, he is a friend of that Eldil of whom I told you, one of those who cling to the wrong good."
"Well, then I must explain it to him," said the lady. "Let us go and make him older."
And with that she slung herself down the rocky edge of the plateau and began descending the mountain slope. Ransom took longer to manage the rocks, but once his feet were again on the turf he began running as fast as he could. The lady cried out in surprise as he flashed past her, but he took no notice. He could now see clearly which bay the little boat was making for, and his attention was fully occupied in directing his course and making sure of his feet. There was only one man in the boat. Down and down the long slope he raced. Now he was in a fold, now in a winding valley which momentarily cut off the sight of the sea. Now at last he was in the cove itself. He glanced back and saw to his dismay that the lady had also been running and was only a few yards behind. He glanced forward again. There were waves, though not yet very large ones, breaking on the pebbly beach. A man in shirt and shorts and a pith helmet was ankle-deep in the water, wading ashore and pulling after him a little canvas punt. It was certainly Weston, though his face had something about it which seemed subtly unfamiliar. It seemed to Ransom of vital importance to prevent a meeting between Weston and the lady. He had seen Weston murder an inhabitant of Malacandra. He turned back, stretching out both arms to bar her way and shouting, "Go back!" She was too near. For a second she was almost in his arms. Then she stood back from him, panting from the race, surprised, her mouth open to speak. But at that moment he heard Weston's voice from behind him, saying in English, "May I ask you, Dr. Ransom, what is the meaning of this?"
Chapter 7.
In all the circumstances, it would have been reasonable to expect that Weston would be much more taken aback at Ransom's presence than Ransom could be at his. But if he were, he showed no sign of it. And Ransom could hardly help admiring the massive egoism which enabled this man, in the very moment of his arrival on an unknown world, to stand there unmoved in all his authoritative vulgarity, his arms akimbo, his face scowling, and his feet planted as solidly on that unearthly soil as if he had been standing with his back to the fire in his own study. Then, with a shock, he noticed that Weston was speaking to the lady in the old solar language with perfect fluency. On Malacandra, partly from incapacity and much more from his contempt for the inhabitants, he had never acquired more than a smattering of it. Here was an inexplicable and disquieting novelty. Ransom felt that his only advantage had been taken from him. He felt that he was now in the presence of the incalculable. If the scales had been suddenly weighted in this one respect, what might come next? He awoke from his abstraction to find that Weston and the lady had been conversing fluently, but without mutual understanding. "It is no use," she was saying. "You and I are not old enough to speak together, it seems. The sea is rising. Let us go back to the islands."
"Will he come with us, Piebald?"
"Where are the two fishes?" said Ransom.
"They will be waiting in the next bay," said the lady.
"Quick, then," said Ransom to her, and then, in answer to her look,
No, he will not come. She did not presumably understand his urgency, but her eye was on the sea, and she understood her own reason for haste. She had already begun to ascend the side of the valley, with Ransom following her, when Weston shouted, "No, you don't!" Ransom turned and found himself covered by a revolver. The sudden heat which swept over his body was the only sign by which he knew that he was frightened. His head remained clear. "Are you going to begin in this world also by murdering one of its inhabitants?" he asked. "What are you saying?" asked the lady, pausing and looking back at the two men with a puzzled, tranquil face. "Stay where you are, Ransom," said the professor. "That native can go where she likes. The sooner the better." Ransom was about to implore her to make good her escape when he realized that no imploring was needed. He had irrationally supposed that she would understand the situation. But apparently she saw nothing more than two strangers talking about something which she did not at the moment understand. That, and her own necessity of leaving the fixed land at once. "You and he do not come with me, Piebald?" she asked. "No," said Ransom, without turning round. "It may be that you and I shall not meet soon again. Greet the king for me, if you find him, and speak of me always to Maleldil. I stay here." "We shall meet when Maleldil pleases," she answered, "or if not, some greater good will happen to us instead." Then he heard her footsteps behind him for a few seconds, and then he heard them no more, and knew he was alone with Weston. "You allowed yourself to use the word murder just now, Dr. Ransom," said the professor, "in reference to an accident that occurred when we were in Malacandra. In any case, the creature killed was not a human being. Allow me to tell you that I consider the seduction of a native girl as an almost equally unfortunate way of introducing civilization to a new planet." "Seduction?" said Ransom. "Oh, I see. You thought I was making love to her." "When I find a naked civilized man embracing a naked savage woman in a solitary place, that is the name I give to it." "I wasn't embracing her," said Ransom dully, for the whole business of defending himself on this score seemed at that moment a mere weariness of the spirit. "And no one wears clothes here. But what does it matter? Get on with the job that brings you to Perelandra." "You ask me to believe that you have been living here with that woman under these conditions in a state of sexless innocence?" "Oh, sexless," said Ransom disgustedly. "All right, if you like. It's about as good a description of living in Perelandra as it would be to say that a man had forgotten water because Niagara Falls didn't immediately give him the idea of making it into cups of tea. But you're right enough if you mean that I have had no more thought of desiring her than... But then..." Comparisons failed him, and his voice died. Then he began again. "But don't say I'm asking you to believe it or to believe anything. I am asking you nothing but to begin and end as soon as possible whatever butcheries and robberies you have come to do." Weston eyed him for a moment with a curious expression. Then, unexpectedly, he turned his revolver to its holster. "Ransom," he said, "you do me a great injustice." For several seconds there was silence between them. Long breakers with white wool packs of foam on them were now rolling into the cove, exactly as on Earth. "Yes," said Weston at last, "and I will begin with a frank admission. You may make what capital of it you please. I shall not be deterred. I deliberately say that I was, in some respects, mistaken, seriously mistaken, in my conception of the whole interplanetary problem when I went to Malacandra." Partly from the relaxation which followed the disappearance of the pistol, and partly from the elaborate air of magnanimity with which the great scientist spoke, Ransom felt very much inclined to laugh. But it occurred to him that this was possibly the first occasion in his whole life in which Weston had ever acknowledged himself in the wrong, and that even the false dawn of humility, which is still 99% of arrogance, ought not to be rebuffed, or not by him. "Well, that's very handsome," he said. "How do you mean?" "I'll tell you presently," said Weston. "In the meantime, I must get my things ashore." Between them they beached the punt and began carrying Weston's primer stove and tins and tent and other packages to a spot about 200 yards inland. Ransom, who knew all the paraphernalia to be needless, made no objection, and in about a quarter of an hour something like an encampment had been established in a mossy place under some blue-trunked, silver-leaved trees beside a rivulet. Both men sat down, and Ransom listened at first with interest, then with amazement, and finally with incredulity.
Weston cleared his throat, threw out his chest, and assumed his lecturing manner. Throughout the conversation that followed, Ransom was filled with a sense of crazy irrelevance. Here were two human beings, thrown together in an alien world under conditions of inconceivable strangeness. The one separated from his spaceship, the other newly released from the threat of instant death. Was it sane? Was it imaginable that they should find themselves at once engaged in a philosophical argument which might just as well have occurred in a Cambridge combination room? Yet that, apparently, was what Weston insisted upon. He showed no interest in the fate of his spaceship. He even seemed to feel no curiosity about Ransom's presence on Venus. Could it be that he had travelled more than 30 million miles of space in search of conversation? But as he went on talking, Ransom felt himself more and more in the presence of a monomaniac, like an actor who cannot think of anything but his celebrity, or a lover who can think of nothing but his mistress. Tense, tedious, and unescapable, the scientist pursued his fixed idea.
"The tragedy of my life," he said, "and indeed of the modern intellectual world in general, is the rigid specialization of knowledge entailed by the growing complexity of what is known. It is my own share in that tragedy that an early devotion to physics has prevented me from paying any proper attention to biology until I reached the 50s. To do myself justice, I should make it clear that the false humanist idea of knowledge as an end in itself never appealed to me. I always wanted to know in order to achieve utility. At first, that utility naturally appeared to me in a personal form. I wanted scholarships, an income, and that generally recognized position in the world without which a man has no leverage. When those were attained, I began to look farther, to the utility of the human race."
He paused as he rounded his period, and Ransom nodded to him to proceed.
"The utility of the human race," continued Weston, "in the long run depends rigidly on the possibility of interplanetary and even intersidereal travel. That problem I solved. The key of human destiny was placed in my hands. It would be unnecessary and painful to us both to remind you how it was wrenched from me in Malacandra by a member of a hostile intelligent species whose existence, I admit, I had not anticipated."
"Or not hostile, exactly," said Ransom. "But go on."
"The rigors of our return journey from Malacandra led to a serious breakdown in my health."
"Mine too," said Ransom.
Weston looked somewhat taken aback by the interruption and went on, "During my convalescence I had that leisure for reflection which I had denied myself for many years. In particular, I reflected on the objections you had felt to that liquidation of the non-human inhabitants of Malacandra, which was, of course, the necessary preliminary to its occupation by our own species. The traditional, and if I may say so, the humanitarian form in which you advanced those objections had till then concealed from me their true strength. That strength I now began to perceive. I began to see that my own exclusive devotion to human utility was really based on an unconscious dualism."
"What do you mean?"
"I mean that all my life I had been making a wholly unscientific dichotomy or antithesis between man and nature, had conceived myself fighting for man against his non-human environment. During my illness I plunged into biology, and particularly into what may be called biological philosophy. Hitherto, as a physicist, I had been content to regard life as a subject outside my scope. The conflicting views of those who drew a sharp line between the organic and the inorganic, and those who held that what we call life was inherent in matter from the very beginning, had not interested me. Now it did. I saw almost at once that I could admit no break, no discontinuity, in the unfolding of the cosmic process. I became a convinced believer in emergent evolution. All is one. The stuff of mind, the unconsciously purposive dynamism, is present from the very beginning." Here he paused. Ransom had heard this sort of thing pretty often before, and wondered when his companion was coming to the point. When Weston resumed, it was with an even deeper solemnity of tone. "The majestic spectacle of this blind, inarticulate purposiveness thrusting its way upward and ever upward, in an endless unity of differentiated achievements towards an ever-increasing complexity of organization, towards spontaneity and spirituality, swept away all my old conception of a duty to man as such. Man in himself is nothing. The forward movement of life, the growing spirituality, is everything. I say to you quite freely, Ransom, that I should have been wrong in liquidating the Malacandrians.
It was a mere prejudice that made me prefer our own race to theirs. To spread spirituality, not to spread the human race, is henceforth my mission. This sets the coping stone on my career. I worked first for myself, then for science, then for humanity, but now at last for spirit itself. I might say, borrowing language which will be more familiar to you, the Holy Spirit.
Now what exactly do you mean by that? Asked Ransom.
I mean, said Weston, that nothing now divides you and me except a few outworn theological technicalities with which organized religion has unhappily allowed itself to get encrusted. But I have penetrated that crust. The meaning beneath it is as true and living as ever. If you will excuse me for putting it that way, the essential truth of the religious view of life finds a remarkable witness in the fact that it enabled you, on Malacandra, to grasp, in your own mythical and imaginative fashion, a truth which was hidden from me.
I don't know much about what people call the religious view of life, said Ransom, wrinkling his brow. You see, I'm a Christian, and what we mean by the Holy Ghost is not a blind, inarticulate purposiveness.
My dear Ransom, said Weston, I understand you perfectly. I have no doubt that my phraseology will seem strange to you, and perhaps even shocking. Early and revered associations may have put it out of your power to recognize in this new form the very same truths which religion has so long preserved and which science is now at last rediscovering. But whether you can see it or not, believe me, we are talking about exactly the same thing.
I'm not at all sure that we are.
That, if you will permit me to say so, is one of the real weaknesses of organized religion, that adherence to formulae, that failure to recognize one's own friends. God is a spirit, Ransom. Get hold of that. You're familiar with that already. Stick to it. God is a spirit.
Well, of course. But what then?
What then? My spirit, mind, freedom, spontaneity, that's what I'm talking about. That is the goal towards which the whole cosmic process is moving. The final disengagement of that freedom, that spirituality...
Thing. He saved others. Now he should save himself, if he really is God's chosen Messiah.
The soldiers made fun of Jesus and brought him some wine. They said, If you are the king of the Jews, save yourself. Above him was a sign that said, This is the king of the Jews. One of the criminals hanging there also insulted Jesus by saying, Aren't you the Messiah? Save yourself and save us. But the other criminal told the first one off. Don't you fear God? Aren't you getting the same punishment as this man? We got what was coming to us, but he didn't do anything wrong. Then he said to Jesus, Remember me when you come into power. Jesus replied, I promise that today you will be with me in paradise. The Death of Jesus. Around noon, the sky turned dark and stayed that way until the middle of the afternoon. The sun stopped shining, and the curtain in the temple split down the middle. Jesus shouted, Father, I put myself in your hands. Then he died. When the Roman officer saw what had happened, he praised God and said, Jesus must really have been a good man. A crowd had gathered to see the terrible sight. Then after they had seen it, they felt brokenhearted and went home. All of Jesus' close friends and the women who had come with him from Galilee stood at a distance and watched. Jesus is buried. There was a man named Joseph who was from Arimathea in Judea. Joseph was a good and honest man, and he was eager for God's kingdom to come. He was also a member of the council, but he did not agree with what they had decided. Joseph went to Pilate and asked for Jesus' body. He took the body down from the cross and wrapped it in fine cloth. Then he put it in a tomb that had been cut out of solid rock and had never been used. It was Friday, and the Sabbath was about to begin. The women who had come with Jesus from Galilee followed Joseph and watched how Jesus' body was placed in the tomb. Then they went to prepare some sweet-smelling spices for his burial. But on the Sabbath they rested, as the law of Moses commands. Jesus is alive. Chapter 24. Very early on Sunday morning, the women went to the tomb, carrying the spices they had prepared. When they found the stone rolled away from the entrance, they went in. But they did not find the body of the Lord Jesus, and they did not know what to think. Suddenly, two men in shining white clothes stood beside them. The women were afraid and bowed to the ground, but the men said, "Why are you looking in the place of the dead for someone who is alive? Jesus isn't here. He has been raised from death. Remember that while he was still in Galilee, he told you, 'The Son of Man will be handed over to sinners who will nail him to a cross. But 3 days later he will rise to life.'" Then they remembered what Jesus had said. Mary Magdalene, Joanna, Mary the mother of James, and some other women were the ones who had gone to the tomb. When they returned, they told the 11 apostles and the others what had happened. The apostles thought it was all nonsense, and they would not believe. But Peter ran to the tomb. And when he stooped down and looked in, he saw only the burial clothes. Then he returned, wondering what had happened. Jesus appears to two disciples. That same day, two of Jesus' disciples were going to the village of Emmaus, which was about 7 miles from Jerusalem. As they were talking and thinking about what had happened, Jesus came near and started walking along beside them. But they did not know who he was. Jesus asked them, "What were you talking about as you walked along?" The two of them stood there looking sad and gloomy. Then the one named Cleopas asked Jesus, "Are you the only person from Jerusalem who didn't know what was happening there these last few days?" "What do you mean?" Jesus asked. They answered, "Those things that happened to Jesus from Nazareth. By what he did and said, he showed that he was a powerful prophet who pleased God and all the people. Then the chief priests and our leaders had him arrested and sentenced to die on a cross. We had hoped that he would be the one to set Israel free, but it has already been 3 days since all this happened." Some women in our group surprised us. They had gone to the tomb early in the morning but did not find the body of Jesus. They came back saying that they had seen a vision of angels who told them that he is alive. Some men from our group went to the tomb and found it just as the women had said, but they didn't see Jesus either. Then Jesus asked the two disciples, "Why can't you understand? How can you be so slow to believe all that the prophet said? Didn't you know that the Messiah would have to suffer before he was given his glory?" Jesus then explained everything written about himself in the scriptures, beginning with the law of Moses and the books of the prophets. When the two of them came near the village where they were going, Jesus seemed to be going farther. They begged him, "Stay with us. It's already late and the sun is going down." So Jesus went into the house to stay with them. After Jesus sat down to eat, he took some bread. He blessed it and broke it. Then he gave it to them. At once, they knew who he was, but he disappeared. They said to each other, "When he talked with us along the road and explained the scriptures to us, didn't it warm our hearts?" So they got right up and returned to Jerusalem. The two disciples found the 11 apostles and the others gathered together, and they learned from the group that the Lord...
"Who then spoke? It was a guess bottle, truly. You took my anger." The voice came out of the shadows. Blinking, Lostari Yil slowly sat up. The fur...
"Self-fortunate. I'm about to die." Dr. He seemed unsurprised by this revelation. Drifting objects, including some small-scale, four-dimensional objects. He lit a cigarette and smoked it in silence. After a while, he said, "Possibly debris from ships or other artifacts surrounded both ships. Captain Chu ordered their immediate return." "Even so, I think you're blessed. Most people don't cast a glance at the universe beyond the world we live in." The plan to board the ring had to be scrapped. Since they now knew their distance from the mothership, screen, when there was no reception. The white noise lasted about 3 minutes, and then a scene from several light years away took its place. It was crystal clear, with no signs of distortion or interference. Cheng Xin had entertained countless guesses as to what she would see. Maybe she would only have voice and text. Maybe she would see a brain floating in nutrient fluid. Maybe she would see Yun Tianming whole. Though she believed that this last possibility was practically impossible, she tried to imagine the environment.
"Wants to know whether this has anything to do with Yun Tianming."
Before departure, Yi Fan reminded A.A. Cheng Xin and Guan Yi Fan stood at the edge of the field and watched as the robots plowed the field to prepare for the next planting. To not communicate with Hunter unless it was an emergency. No one knew what other extraterrestrial monitoring equipment might be lurking. The granary was now full, so there was no room for more wheat. Before, working in this system, and any communication could expose them to danger. In this lonely world of only three people, they would have debated what to plant for the next season. But now, both of them were troubled and had no interest in the topic. Even a brief separation was an occasion for anxiety. A.A. hugged Cheng Xin and Guan Yi Fan and wished. Throughout the entire harvest and threshing process, they had stayed in the house and discussed possible future them a safe journey. Before stepping onto the shuttle, Cheng Xin looked back and saw A.A. waving at them. They realized that even their individual life choices affected the fate of the universe, or lit by the watery starlight. Blue grass surged around her, and the cold wind lifted her short hair, and in the fates of multiple universes. They really felt like God. The weight of red ripples in the grass. The shuttle took off. In the view from the monitoring system, Cheng Xin's responsibility made it hard to breathe, and so they left the house. They saw Sofan walking toward them, saw the grass lit up by the flame from the thruster, and the blue grass scattering in every direction. As the shuttle rose up along one of the field ridges, Sofan rarely disturbed them, and only appeared when they needed her. This time, the bright patch on the ground quickly dimmed, and soon, the ground sank back into starlight. An hour constant, just like we now think the same, of 300,000 kilometers per second. Of course, I've only brought up two examples. Other universal laws of physics have been used as weapons as well, though we don't know all of them. It's very possible that every law of physics has been weaponized. It's possible that in some parts of the universe, even... Forget it. I don't even believe that. What were you going to say? The foundation of mathematics. Cheng Xin tried to imagine it, but it was simply impossible. That's madness. Then she asked, will the universe turn into a war ruin? Or maybe it's more accurate to ask, will the laws of physics turn into war ruins?
Maybe they already are.
Microscopic into the microscopic, and the speed of light was reduced again and again.
As I said, I'm not saying anything, just guessing.
Yi Fan's voice grew softer.
I wish I'd never set eyes on it.
Chapter 8. He woke, after a disturbed and dreamful sleep, in full daylight. He had a dry mouth, a crick in his neck, and a soreness in his limbs. It was so unlike all previous wakings in the world of Venus that for a moment he supposed himself back on Earth. And the dream, for so it seemed to him, of having lived and walked on the oceans of the morning star, rushed through his memory with a sense of lost sweetness that was well nigh unbearable. Then he sat up, and the facts came back to him. "It's jolly nearly the same as having waked from a dream, though," he thought. Hunger and thirst became at once his dominant sensations, but he conceived it a duty to look first at the sick man, though with very little hope that he could help him. He gazed round. There was the grove of silvery trees, all right, but he could not see Weston. Then he glanced at the bay. There was no punt, either. Assuming that in the darkness he had blundered into the wrong valley, he rose and approached the stream for a drink. As he lifted his face from the water with a long sigh of satisfaction, his eyes suddenly fell on a little wooden box, and then beyond it on a couple of tins. His brain was working rather slowly, and it took him a few seconds to realize that he was in the right valley after all, and a few more to draw conclusions from the fact that the box was open and empty, and that some of the stores had been removed and others left behind. But was it possible that a man in Weston's physical condition could have recovered sufficiently during the night to strike camp and to go away laden with some kind of pack? Was it possible that any man could have faced a sea like that in a collapsible punt? It was true, as he now noticed for the first time, that the storm, which had been a mere squall by Perelandrian standards, appeared to have blown itself out during the night. But there was still a quite formidable swell, and it seemed out of the question that the professor could have left the island. Much more probably he had left the valley on foot and carried the punt with him. Ransom decided that he must find Weston at once. He must keep in touch with his enemy. For if Weston had recovered, there was no doubt he meant mischief of some kind. Ransom was not at all certain that he had understood all his wild talk on the previous day, but what he did understand he disliked very much, and suspected that this vague mysticism about spirituality would turn out to be something even nastier than his old and comparatively simple program of planetary imperialism. It would be unfair to take seriously the things the man had said immediately before his seizure, no doubt, but there was enough without that. The next few hours Ransom passed in searching the island for food and for Weston. As far as food was concerned, he was rewarded. Some fruit like bilberries could be gathered in handfuls on the upper slopes, and the wooded valleys abounded in a kind of oval nut. The kernel had a toughly soft consistency, rather like cork or kidneys, and the flavour, though somewhat austere and prosaic after the fruit of the floating islands, was not unsatisfactory. The giant mice were as tame as other Perelandrian beasts, but seemed stupider. Ransom ascended to the central plateau. The sea was dotted with islands in every direction, rising and falling with the swell, and all separated from one another by wide stretches of water. His eye at once picked out an orange-coloured island, but he did not know whether it was that on which he had been living, for he saw at least two others in which the same colour predominated. At one time he counted 23 floating islands in all. That, he thought, was more than the temporary archipelago had contained, and allowed him to hope that any one of those he saw might hide the king, or that the king might even at this moment be reunited to the lady. Without thinking it out very clearly, he had come to rest almost all his hopes on the king. Of Weston he could find no trace. It really did seem, in spite of all improbabilities, that he had somehow contrived to leave the fixed island. And Ransom's anxiety was very great. What Weston, in his new vein, might do, he had no idea. The best to hope for was that he would simply ignore the master and mistress of Perelandra as mere savages or natives. Late in the day, being tired, he sat down on the shore. There was very little swell now, and the waves, just before they broke, were less than knee-deep. His feet, made soft by the mattress-like surface which one walks on in those floating islands, were hot and sore. Presently he decided to refresh them by a little wading.
The delicious quality of the water drew him out till he was waist-deep. As he stood there, deep in thought, he suddenly perceived that what he had taken to be an effective light on the water was really the back of one of the great silvery fish. "I wonder would it let me ride it," he thought. And then, watching how the beast nosed towards him and kept itself as near the shallows as it dared, it was borne in upon him that it was trying to attract his attention. Could it have been sent? The thought had no sooner darted through his mind than he decided to make the experiment. He laid his hand across the creature's back, and it did not flinch from his touch. Then, with some difficulty, he scrambled into a sitting position across the narrow part behind its head, and while he was doing this, it remained as nearly stationary as it could. But as soon as he was firmly in the saddle, it whisked itself about and headed for the sea. If he had wished to withdraw, it was very soon impossible to do so. Already the green pinnacles of the mountain, as he looked back, had withdrawn their summits from the sky, and the coastline of the island had begun to conceal its bays and nesses. The breakers were no longer audible, only the prolonged sibilant or chattering noises of the water about him. Many floating islands were visible, though seen from this level they were mere feathery silhouettes. But the fish seemed to be heading for none of these. Straight on, as if it well knew its way, the beat of the great fins carried him for more than an hour. Then green and purple splashed the whole world, and after that, darkness. Somehow he felt hardly any uneasiness when he found himself swiftly climbing and descending the low hills of water through the black night. And here it was not all black. The heavens had vanished, and the surface of the sea, but far, far below him, in the heart of the vacancy through which he appeared to be travelling, strange bursting star-shells and writhing streaks of a bluish-green luminosity appeared. At first they were very remote, but soon, as far as he could judge, they were nearer. A whole world of phosphorescent creatures seemed to be at play not far from the surface, coiling eels and darting things in complete armour. And then heraldically fantastic shapes to which the seahorse of our own waters would be commonplace. They were all round him, 20 or 30 of them often in sight at once. And mixed with all this riot of sea centaurs and sea dragons, he saw yet stranger forms. Fishes, if fishes they were, whose forward part was so nearly human in shape that when he first caught sight of them, he thought he had fallen into a dream and shook himself to awake. But it was no dream. There, and there again. It was unmistakable. Now a shoulder, now a profile, and then for one second a full face. Veritable mermen or mermaids. The resemblance to humanity was indeed greater, not less, than he had first supposed. What had for a moment concealed it from him was the total absence of human expression. Yet the faces were not idiotic. They were not even brutal parodies of humanity like those of our terrestrial apes. They were more like human faces asleep, or faces in which humanity slept while some other life, neither bestial nor diabolic, but merely elvish, out of our orbit, was irrelevantly awake. He remembered his old suspicion that what was myth in one world might always be fact in some other. He wondered also whether the king and queen of Perelandra, though doubtless the first human pair of this planet, might on the physical side have a marine ancestry. And if so, what then of the man-like things before men in our own world? Must they in truth have been the wistful brutalities whose pictures we see in popular books on evolution? Or were the old myths truer than the modern myths? Had there in truth been a time when satyrs danced in the Italian woods? But he said hush to his mind at this stage, for the mere pleasure of breathing in the fragrance which now began to steal towards him from the blackness ahead. Warm and sweet, and every moment sweeter and purer, and every moment stronger and more filled with all delights, it came to him. He knew well what it was. He would know it henceforward out of the whole universe, the night breath of a floating island in the star Venus. It was strange to be filled with homesickness for places where his sojourn had been so brief, and which were, by any objective standard, so alien to all our race. Or were they? The cord of longing which drew him to the invisible isle seemed to him at that moment to have been fastened long, long before his coming to Perelandra, long before the earliest times that memory could recover in his childhood, before his birth, before the birth of man himself, before the origins of time. It was sharp, sweet, wild, and holy, all in one, and in any world where men's nerves have ceased to obey their central desires, would doubtless have been aphrodisiac too, but not in Perelandra. The fish was no longer moving. Ransom put out his hand. He found he was touching weed. He crawled forward over the head of the monstrous fish and levered himself onto the gently moving surface of the island. Short as his absence from such places had been, his earth-trained habits of walking had reasserted themselves, and he fell more than once as he groped his way on the heaving lawn. But it did no harm falling here. Good luck to it. There were trees all about him in the dark, and when a smooth, cool, rounded object came away in his hand, he put it, unfearing, to his lips. It was none of the fruits he had tasted before. It was better than any of them. Well might the lady say of her world that the fruit you ate at any moment was, at that moment, the best. Wearied with his day's walking and climbing, and still more, borne down by absolute satisfaction, he sank into dreamless sleep. He felt that it was several hours later when he awoke and found himself still in darkness. He knew, too, that he had been suddenly waked. And a moment later he was listening to the sound that had waked him. It was the sound of voices, a man's voice and a woman's in earnest conversation. He judged that they were very close to him, for in a Perelandrian night an object is no more visible 6 inches than 6 miles away. He perceived at once who the speakers were, but the voices sounded strange, and the emotions of the speakers were obscure to him, with no facial expression to eke them out. "I am wondering," said the woman's voice, "whether all the people of your world have the habit of talking about the same thing more than once. I have said already that we are forbidden to dwell on the fixed land. Why do you not either talk of something else or stop talking?"
"Because this forbidding is such a strange one," said the man's voice, "and so unlike the ways of Maleldil in my world. And he has not forbidden you to think about dwelling on the fixed land."
"Well, that would be a strange thing, to think about what will never happen."
"Nay, in our world we do it all the time. We put words together to mean things that have never happened and places that never were, beautiful words, well put together, and then tell them to one another. We call it stories or poetry. In that old world you spoke of, Malakandra, they did the same. It is for mirth and wonder and wisdom."
"What is the wisdom in it?"
"Because the world is made up not only of what is, but of what might be. Maleldil knows both and wants us to know both."
"Well, this is more than I ever thought of. The other, the piebald one, has already told me things which made me feel like a tree whose branches were growing wider and wider apart. But this goes beyond all. Stepping out of what is into what might be, and talking and making things out there alongside the world. I will ask the king what he thinks of it."
"You see, that is what we always come back to. If only you had not been parted from the king."
"Oh, I see. That also is one of the things that might be. The world might be so made that the king and I were never parted."
"The world would not have to be different, only the way you live. In a world where people live on the fixed lands, they do not become suddenly separated."
"But you remember, we are not to live on the fixed land."
"No, but he has never forbidden you to think about it. Might not that be one of the reasons why you are forbidden to do it? So that you may have a might-be to think about, to make a story about, as we call it?"
"I will think more of this. I will get the king to make me older about it."
"How greatly I desire to meet this king of yours. But in the matter of stories he may be no older than you himself."
"That saying of yours is like a tree with no fruit. The king is always older than I, and about all things."
"But Piebald and I have already made you older about certain matters which the king never mentioned to you. That is the new good which you never expected. You thought you would always learn all things from the king, but now Maleldil has sent you other men whom it never entered your mind to think of, and they have told you things the king himself could not know."
"I begin to see now why the king and I were parted at this time. This is a strange and great good he intended for me."
"And if you refused to learn things from me and kept on saying you would wait and ask the king, would that not be like turning away from the fruit you had found to the fruit you had expected?"
"These are deep questions, stranger. Maleldil is not putting much into my mind about them."
"Or do you not see why?"
"No."
"Since Piebald and I have come to your world, we have put many things into your mind which Maleldil has not. Do you not see that he is letting go of your hand a little?
How could he? He is wherever we go.
Yes, but in another way. He is making you older, making you to learn things not straight from him, but by your own meetings with other people and your own questions and thoughts.
He is certainly doing that.
Yes. He is making you a full woman, for up till now you are only half-made, like the beasts who do nothing of themselves. This time, when you meet the king again, it is you who will have things to tell him. It is you who will be older than he, and who will make him older.
Well, Maleldil would not make a thing like that happen. It would be like a fruit with no taste.
But it would have a taste for him. Do you not think the king must sometimes be tired of being the older? Would he not love you more if you were wiser than he?
Is this what you call a poetry, or do you mean that it really is?
I mean a thing that really is.
But how could anyone love anything more? It is like saying a thing could be bigger than itself.
I only meant you could become more like the women of my world.
What are they like?
They are of a great spirit. They always reach out their hands for the new and unexpected good, and see that it is good long before the men understand it. Their minds run ahead of what Maleldil has told them. They do not need to wait for him to tell them what is good, but know it for themselves, as he does. They are, as it were, little Maleldils. And because of their wisdom, their beauty is as much greater than yours as the sweetness of these gourds surpasses the taste of water. And because of their beauty, the love which the men have for them is as much greater than the king's love for you, as the naked burning of deep heaven seen from my world is more wonderful than the golden roof of yours.
I wish I could see them.
I wish you could.
How beautiful is Maleldil, and how wonderful are all his works. Perhaps he will bring out of me daughters as much greater than I am greater than the beasts. It will be better than I